Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Today I'll be reading about wetlands and beavers, two of my favorite subjects. I'll be reading from a New Yorker article, Swamps Can Protect Against Climate Change If We Only Let Them, by Annie Prue, and from a book by Ben Goldfarb called Eager, The Surprising Secret Lives of Beavers and Why They Matter. Annie Prue is best known for her Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award winner, The Shipping News, and her short story, Brokeback Mountain. And Ben Goldfarb has written extensively for High Country News, and his writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The National Geographic, Washington Post, New York Times, Science, and many other publications. I've been wanting to read about wetlands for months now. I've only in recent years become more deeply aware of their vast importance to all of our well-being, giving us free, clean water and a home to a myriad of species of plants and animals. We need to understand and appreciate their awesome powers and why we need to restore wet areas that have been destroyed and protect those that remain. The Environmental Protection Agency website says, "Wetlands are among the most productive ecosystems in the world, comparable to rainforests and coral reefs. An immense variety of species of microbes, plants, insects, amphibians, reptiles, birds, fish, and mammals can be part of a wetland ecosystem." I'll start with part of an article in The New Yorker, July 4th, 2022, by Annie Prue, and then go on to Ben Goldfarb's introduction to the book Eager. Here's Annie Prue. "It is in and around wetlands that the greatest blossoming of biodiversity has occurred. It is not too much to say that we owe our existence to this planet's wetlands, including fens, bogs, and swamps. Our wholesale destruction of wetlands for the sake of a few decades of growing wheat, rice, soy, and palm oil has been breathtakingly short-sighted." Further on, she writes, "My most intimate swamp experience came one summer when I lived in a remote and ramshackle house in Vermont with a beaver-populated swamp half a mile down in the bottomland. I went to the swamp almost every day by a circuitous route through the woods, passing a patch of pitcher plants and two or three sundews across a brook, following the beavers' tree-drag ruts to an old stick dam. There were trout in this swamp and beautiful painted turtles. I watched the amazing acrobatics of dragonflies with disbelief that they were actually doing what I saw them do. Even when I sat on the back porch high above the swamp, I thought I could catch the green smell of bruised lily pads. Once, after weeks away, I came back to the house in the late afternoon. I had started reading Norman MacLean's story, A River Runs Through It, on the plane ride home and decided to read to the end before I went inside the house. It was an utterly quiet, windless day, the light softening to peach nectar. I read the last page and its famous final line, 'I am haunted by waters.' I closed the book and looked toward the swamp. Sitting on a stone wall, 15 feet away, was a large bobcat who had been watching me read. When our eyes met, the cat slipped into the tall grass like a ribbon of water, and I watched the grass quiver as it headed down to the woods, to the stream, to the swamp." Prue goes on to write, "It is an important decision to restore even a small piece of wetland that has been severely mauled. Once a few interested people put on their boots and go into the damaged wetland, and once their curiosity is aroused about how the water moves and what plants, amphibians, and birds formerly thrived in their local remnant swamp, they are hard to stop. There is unequal joy in restoration." She ends her essay with these words, "I remember another small and nameless Vermont larch swamp which could be reached only by passage through a dark and gloomy ravine that I thought of as the Slough of Despond. At the bottom of the ravine ran Jacob's Chopping Brook. The flurried, emotional water of the brook contrasted with the black glass disk of swamp water that seemed made to reflect passing clouds, but under rain showed itself as dimpled pewter. It has been 50 years since I last saw it, but it is still with me. And that's Annie Prue in the July 4th, 2022 New Yorker. She spells her last name P-R-O-U-L-X. And now, on to the introduction to the book Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter, by Ben Goldfarb. This book takes us to places mostly west of the 100th meridian. The dates he cites for the height of beaver trapping in the west reveal that in the eastern part of the country, the beavers had been wiped out for a century. For example, in the Milwaukee River watershed, beavers were wiped out by 1730. Now we head to Wyoming. The first time I tried to meet Drew Reed, the most prolific beaver mover in the state of Wyoming, I was thwarted by a sick goat. Reed and I had made plans to rendezvous in Jackson. I was en route when Reed called, his drawl pinched with concern. One of his goats, a 220-pounder named Maximus, had been laid low by a mysterious malady, and the vet needed to intervene as soon as possible. Reed was sorry, but he'd have to postpone until his beloved creature had been cured. Maybe, he added, hopefully Maximus just needed some electrolytes. I was disappointed, but also felt some admiration. Here was a guy who cared enough about animals that he'd blow off a human engagement to tend to the health of a ruminant. A month later, when Maximus was in finer fettle, I found myself in the front seat of Reed's pickup, bouncing along a dirt road through the Grovant Valley. A transverse crack glittered in the windshield. The rear window was plastered with a decal of a T-Rex-sized billy, terrorizing tiny humans, accompanied by the phrase, "My goat ate your stick family." A boxy white trailer rattled in our wake, threatening to decouple from Reed's truck with every rut. Reed and his wife, Amy, normally used the trailer to tote Maximus. Today it conveyed a more sensitive cargo. "I hope they're doing okay back there," Reed muttered. The road, pocked with potholes deep enough to drown in, clung tight to the hillside, nearly forcing us to trade paint with cars creeping in the opposite direction. The Grovant River ran below, a shimmering blue thread twisting through sere sagebrush meadows. Reed, a baseball cap yanked low over his shaved head, grumbled at unyielding drivers. At last the road descended into the valley, where an amber tributary called Cottonwood Creek gushed into the main stream of the Grovant. Reed executed a nimble three-point turn and backed his rig down to the creek so that the trailer's rear door opened onto the water. He clambered down from the cab for a quick debrief. "The main thing we have to be prepared for is they could separate," he warned me and a few onlookers who'd followed in a separate car. "It's doubtful they're going to go upstream like I'd like for them to do, path of least resistance and all. I'm going to do everything in my power to keep them together. The last thing we need is someone running between them." He paused for emphasis. "The welfare of these animals is always paramount over people's enjoyment." A chorus of "I agree" rose from the small crowd. "All right then," Reed said. He unlatched the trailer door, lowering it onto the creek to form a ramp. Then he stepped back. The beaver, who poked her head from the straw-covered bed of Drew Reed's trailer, was big enough to make me inhale involuntarily. If you have ever seen a beaver, you've probably seen her swimming at a distance, with most of her estimable mass concealed iceberg-like underwater, a misleading view that creates the impression that beavers are a little larger than house cats. Not so. This animal weighed 60 pounds, as much as many golden retrievers, a dense bolus of muscle and fat and milk chocolate fur, the linebacker of the animal kingdom. She, a pronoun I assigned her at random as beavers' sexes are notoriously difficult to discern, stood precariously on her hind legs in the doorway, nose twitching as she surveyed her surroundings, front paws held to her chest tentatively like Oliver Twist, asking for more gruel. But her caution didn't last long. Here was running water and standing cottonwood, all the habitat and food that a bark-noshing, semi-aquatic rodent could desire. The beaver dropped to all fours and waddled down the ramp, hips and rump swaying like the ponderous bulk of a stegosaurus. This was not an animal well-suited for land travel. "Hey, bud," Reed cooed. "Water, huh? You like water?" No sooner had the hefty adult emerged than she was followed by a baby beaver, a kit, hardly larger than a chihuahua. We murmured our delight. Even the hard-boiled Reed, I figured, would have to admit the thing was pretty dang cute. The juvenile hesitated, and Reed gave it a swift pat on the butt as you would an obstinate horse. "Go with Mom," he chided. The two beavers scudded into the stream, weaving back and forth, half swimming and half walking, the water not quite deep enough to submerge. They looked understandably disoriented. They'd endured a long journey in a dark chamber, been flung into new environs, and were surrounded by strange hairless bipeds. Their ordeal, I thought, was like getting snatched by aliens from your bed, spending a day in isolation aboard a mysterious mothership, and then being dumped unceremoniously into a cornfield in Topeka. That confusion, perhaps, explained what happened next. With a flick of his oar-like tail, the kid abandoned his parent and took off downstream, slipping like a trout over a rocky rapid. In defiance of Reed's fervent wishes, the pair was separating. Absent an adult, the kit would surely perish, either of starvation or in a cougar's jaws. Reed dashed over the cobble toward the bottom of the rapid, where he stood in shin-deep water, crouched like a shortstop preparing to corral a wicked grounder. Deftly, he plunged his arm into the stream, and to our astonishment hoisted the kit up by his leathery tail, holding him aloft like a trophy fish. Other handlers before and since have warned me against carrying beavers by the tail for fear of dislocating the appendage. Although Reed isn't persuaded by the dislocation theory, he doesn't make a habit of tail grabbing either. But in the heat of the moment, what choice did he have? The little booger got into the deep hole right in front of me, and I was like, "Oh, no," Reed told me later after the beavers had been reunited and shooed upstream. "There's really no other place on a beaver to grab them." The Gros Ventre River flows into Jackson Hole, the glacier-flattened valley that lies beneath the bladed Teton Range. Today, Jackson Hole is a playground for the Patagonia class, a ritzy sprawl of ski slopes and mountain biking trails and upscale art galleries. 2 centuries ago, though, the valley was defined by fur. In the autumn of 1807, John Coulter, a former member of the Lewis and Clark expedition, followed the Bighorn River into the Rocky Mountains to trade with the Crow Indians. Coulter wandered Wyoming for months in the snowbound dead of winter, toting little more than a rifle and a pack. Although no one's quite certain where his route took him, he's considered the first white man to enter the hole, a word trappers used to describe broad, game-filled valleys. He also found lots of beavers. In the decades that followed, a parade of fortune seekers followed Coulter's footsteps into the northern Rockies, a region that, blared one newspaper, possessed a wealth of furs not surpassed by the mines of Peru. These travelers were the famed mountain men, rapacious beaver trappers who, between the early 1820s and the late 1840s, systematically ransacked just about every pond and stream between Colorado and California. Most of those pelts flowed to the Missouri River and thence to St. Louis, to be shipped off to the East Coast or Europe for conversion into fashionable hats. With breathtaking speed, the mountain men demolished their resource, virtually wiping out beavers throughout the American West. Quote, the trappers often remarked to each other as they rode over these lonely plains that it was time for the white man to leave the mountains, unquote. Osborne Russell, a beaver hunter who frequented Wyoming and Utah, wrote in 1841, as beaver and game had nearly disappeared. Although the reign of the mountain men was brief, they left an enduring ecological legacy. If you know nothing else about beavers, you're probably aware that they build dams, walls of wood, mud, and rock that hold back water and form ponds and wetlands. The rodents also construct lodges, towering houses that often rise from open water like volcanic islands. These structures don't just house beavers themselves. Trumpeter swans squat rent-free atop beaver lodges, commandeering them as nesting platforms upon which their chicks shelter from land-bound predators like foxes. The majestic white birds also crave the Elodea, sago pondweed, and other aquatic plants that grow in shallow beaver ponds. By trapping out the northern Rockies beavers, the mountain men unwittingly destroyed countless acres of prime swan habitat. A few decades later, farmers and ranchers finished the job by draining wetlands to make way for cattle and alfalfa. Today, only 90 or so resident trumpeter pairs linger in the region, and chicks seldom survive. Quote, beaver ponds would have been strung out like necklaces down these drainages, and this landscape would have been a giant sponge, unquote, a swan biologist named Ruth Shea told me. Quote, that's why there were swans nesting everywhere. Swans are the poster child for the importance of the beaver, unquote. This is where I'll stop reading Eager for today. I'm going to continue next week. We'll learn more about Drew Reed and people who translocate beavers into areas where they've been extirpated, attempting to reestablish their populations and create wetlands. I love this topic, wetlands and beavers. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.